Good afternoon and welcome to Middle East in Focus. I'm Esti Chandler. After originally claiming to be looking into the killing of 21-year-old Palestinian nurse and volunteer medic Razan Al-Najjar last week by an Israeli military sniper while she was running to tend to a wounded demonstrator at a Great Return March demonstration in Gaza a week ago Friday, Israeli officials pivoted to saying she was not killed intentionally. When political cartoonists and others started mocking that claim, Israeli officials went to their favorite deflection, shouting Hamas. But this time, it has backfired, as Israeli officials were harshly criticized on social media this week for deceptively editing video footage and making the claim that Razan Al-Najjar was acting as a human shield for Hamas. Known for her bravery, positivity, and angelic smile, her death prompted an international outcry, as her youth and outspokenness to the media prior to her death brought about a flood of worldwide sympathy. Razan Al-Najjar was the second Palestinian medic to be killed since the beginning of the Great Return March, which is just one of the many reasons why I wanted to talk to today's first guest, who wrote in the preface to her most recent book, quote, "I found I had to re-examine the meaning of my own Jewishness in light of the uncomfortable consequences of Zionism, and I started to grapple with my own personal responsibility as a Jew, a U.S. citizen, in a world rife with contradiction, fear, and conflict." I am very happy to have Dr. Alice Rothschild joining us today. Dr. Alice Rothschild is a co-founder of the Urban Woman and Child Health, Inc. in Jamaica Plains, Massachusetts, a nonprofit organization of physicians, midwives, and nurse practitioners that provided OBGYN and pediatric care to the urban poor community. In 1988, she joined Harvard Vanguard Medical Associates and served as an assistant professor of obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive biology at Harvard Medical School until November of 2013, when she became a corresponding member of the faculty of the medical school. Following decades of involvement in progressive politics that started in the 1960s, in 1997, Dr. Rothschild turned much of her non-medical focus to understanding and writing about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. She co-founded American Jews for a Just Peace Boston and co-organized their Health and Human Rights Project. She's an active member of Jewish Voice for Peace Boston and a pivotal member of the Jewish Voice for Peace Health Advisory Council. Dr. Rothschild also serves on the board of the Gaza Mental Health Foundation and Just World Educational. Dr. Rothschild has published three books. In 2007, Broken Promises, Broken Dreams, Stories of Jewish and Palestinian Trauma and Resilience, Voices Across the Divide. In 2014, On the Brink, Israel and Palestine on the Eve of the 2014 Gaza Invasion. And her third book, Condition Critical, Life and Death in Israel-Palestine, which was published last year. I am very happy to welcome Dr. Alice Rothschild to Middle East in Focus.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time to be with us today. Dr. Rothschild, to the horror of people around the world, on Friday, June 1st, 21-year-old Palestinian nurse and medic Razan Al-Najjar was killed by a shot in the chest by highly trained Israeli military snipers while she was working as a volunteer medic at the Great Return March in Gaza. Can you discuss Israel's open fire policy and how Razan's murder actually fits a pattern of targeting medics, ambulances, and other medical apparatus at the Great Return March in Gaza, and the history of Israeli targeting of medical personnel and facilities in Gaza?
Sure. I think the first thing we have to understand is that there is a principle of medical neutrality, which is enshrined in human rights law and in the Fourth Geneva Convention. And that says that medical personnel should not ever be targeted in a warlike situation. So this is already a violation of multiple human rights and international conventions. There is a long-standing pattern of targeting medics and medical personnel that's really quite well documented. If folks are interested, on the website of Medical Aid for Palestinians, there's actually an infographic documenting all the attacks in on personnel and facilities in West Bank and Gaza since 2008. They document just in Gaza 147 hospitals and clinics and 80 ambulances were destroyed, and 145 medical workers were injured or killed, and that was before the current March of Return. So that's the context in which this is all happening. And in the recent weeks, there has been a lot of documentation of targeting of medical personnel. If you look at the El Mazan Center for Human Rights, they note a pattern of attacks on both staff and equipment and patient care units. They note that the Israeli Defense Force is using live ammunition, rubber-coated bullets, and tear gas, and that there have been dozens of injuries and casualties and damaged equipment and ambulances with medical personnel involved. They had cited 79 medics injured and 20 ambulances damaged. I've seen a whole bunch of different numbers depending on when people are reporting and I think how they count different kinds of medical personnel. The highest number I saw was 223 medics injured. So whatever the numbers are, this is a clearly documented pattern, and it is also a clear violation of international and human rights law.
Right. I wonder where your counterparts in the Israeli healthcare community are on these high number of people killed. I think it's over 130 people have been killed so far, and over 13,600 people have been documented injured. Like you said, the numbers vary a bit depending on the source. But you know, most of the people who were killed and injured, the really overwhelming majority of them were peacefully protesting at, you know, these Great Return marches in Gaza. Where are the Israeli healthcare professionals on this?
Well, you know, I can't speak for Israeli health professionals in general, but I can say what I see in terms of websites and news reports. The main organization that has raised their voice is Physicians for Human Rights Israel. They actually had a delegation of providers that were allowed to go into Gaza. The Israelis don't allow the Jewish doctors to go in, but they allow the Palestinians with Israeli citizenship to go in. They're the only official medical organization that I've seen have any response. There was just recently a very interesting letter signed by 30 Israeli oncologists calling for the Israeli security to allow Gazans with cancer diagnoses to have their treatment in Israel. There's a lot of problems now getting permits to get medical treatment, which is just part of this whole saga. It's not directly related to injuries, but it is directly related to a long-standing assault on the ability of Gazans to obtain health care, and also for the Gazan hospital system to maintain itself. So, you know, this is all happening within a context of years of siege, and if you look at the stuff that's coming out of the UN and the British Medical Journal, there is a definite restrictions on essential medications and equipment, and I mean they're running out of things like antibiotics, anesthetics, painkillers, I mean essential drugs that are needed for patient care and also for patient care in this tremendous emergency. I mean, there's been no elective surgery in Gaza since January of this year because they just can't afford to do that, and three hospitals have closed. So this outrageous stuff is going on, and there is not a major outcry from the Israeli medical world, as far as I can see.
That's a shame. It really is. I wonder if you can tell us about the Jewish Voice for Peace Health Advisory Council and your mission. I always want to disclose that I also organize with Jewish Voice for Peace here in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the Jewish Voice for Peace Health Advisory Council is a group of health providers of various kinds, and we had got together to both document and publicize and investigate the impact of occupation and siege on healthcare in its broadest sense, so public health, acute care, chronic care. And so what we do is both survey the information that's coming out. Some of us travel to the region and document it. And we also help organize petitions and sign, you know, protests and that kind of thing, and also educate people. So we have about 125 people on our email list. We have a very active website. So we have various projects that are both, you know, internet-based and also earth-based, to educate people and to make that connection that, you know, the ultimate risk to health is war and occupation.
That's excellent. I will post links so that people listening who want to get on your email list can.
Sure.
I know I've read just you know, some of this stuff, and it's been, you know, really, really informative.
Well, I really suggest people, you know, sign up so they get our notices. But also, if you just go to the website, every month we put out something called Media Watch, which is a whole group of us are monitoring the media and various groups. And then what I do is I put together the different topics and all the articles, pertinent articles written on that topic. So if you just want a monthly summary of health consequences, it's kind of all very easily accessible, and you can just click on the links and read as much as you want. But it really, every month when I put this together with the help of my colleagues, you know, I get this new sense of outrage because the impact is so clear. And the other thing we do is a weekly human rights hero and human rights villain. The villain is always hard to pick because there's so many of them. But with the human rights hero, we want to emphasize the resilience and perseverance of Palestinians in this very difficult situation. But it's, again, a constant reminder to people that there are health and human rights consequences to the realities on the ground.
This is Middle East in Focus on KPFK. I'm discussing Israel's targeting of healthcare workers and facilities in Gaza with Dr. Alice Rothschild, who, friend of our show, journalist and author Ben Ehrenreich, writes, quote, in condition critical, Alice Rothschild grabs for the truth behind the lies, writing with extraordinary moral clarity and a sharp eye for the injustices, absurdities, and cruel historical ironies that define Palestinian life on both sides of the Green Line, end quote. Certainly a rave review from our friend Ben Ehrenreich. Dr. Rothschild, this week, human rights organization Save the Children issued a report warning that an entire generation of children in Gaza are on the brink of a mental health crisis. They found that at least 68% of children say they have difficulty sleeping, and 78% consider the single biggest source of fear for them was the sound of war planes. You're on the board of the Gaza Mental Health Foundation. Would you speak to this aspect of the health crisis in Gaza, please?
Sure. Well, the Health Foundation supports the Gaza Community Mental Health Program, Middle East Children's Alliance, other groups that are working on mental health issues in Gaza. And I've also visited Gaza three times and worked with the Gaza Mental Health Community Mental Health Program. And what is very clear is that if you look at you know, the children in Gaza, and over half of Gaza is children. If you think about it, in a little over 10 years, these children have endured three major wars and a lot of incursions and killing and bombing and tear gassing and loss of parents and relatives and home demolitions and of a magnitude that is really hard for us to comprehend. Like the executive director, the head psychiatrist of the Gaza Community Mental Health Program lost 27 family members in 2014. It's that kind of numbers that just take your breath away. So if you think about the context that these children are living in, there's no such thing as post-traumatic stress disorder because it's never post. So if you look at symptoms of trauma, children in Gaza have a huge amount of bedwetting, nightmares, you know, difficulties going to school, you know, all the kinds of things that traumatized children experience, and it's because of the situation in which they are living. And it's very clear. I mean, any child anywhere would be traumatized by the situation in which they find themselves, and it's a real tribute to their families and to the society and to people not giving up and continuing to struggle and try to create safe moments that these kids are moving forward in their lives. But there's just a huge amount of psychological need amongst the youth and the adults, because the adults are the ones who are trying to hold everything together, are out, you know, getting shot at or bombed or whatever is happening, and that all gets transmitted down to the family.
It's just a tragic. Last week, the International Committee of the Red Cross announced sending two surgical teams to Gaza to help with what they call the unprecedented health crisis. Their head of operations for the Middle East explained that hundreds of people needing treatment for live ammunition wounds will require 3 to 5 complex surgeries each. In April, a Physicians for Human Rights emergency delegation returned from Gaza and issued a statement that said the most advanced hospital in Gaza felt like the 1970s. Can you talk about what that means for Palestinians in need of medical attention? I know you touched on it a bit earlier.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, you know, I just think, first of all, if one of our modern U.S. hospitals had to deal with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of injuries every day, they would be overwhelmed. So you take a hospital system that has already been depleted by years of siege, bombing attacks. You know, the only major first world primary care, rehab hospital in Gaza was leveled to the ground in 2014. So there's no major rehab facility. So if you take a system that's already kind of down and out, and then you add a huge number of patients who are extremely injured, you have the crisis that we have now. And one of the problems is that the snipers aimed at the lower extremities, and they were using bullets that tend to explode. I don't know enough about bullets to talk about this intelligently, but these bullets have caused an extreme amount of tissue and bone damage. So the patients that they're seeing have major orthopedic needs, and reconstruction, saving limbs, will require multiple surgeries and very high-tech, high-level interventions. And these hospitals, you know, if you don't have enough anesthesia, you're not going to be able to do that. So what's happening is, insult to injury, the Israeli security are not allowing these folks to get permits to go get high-level treatment outside of Gaza. So they get hit twice, basically, or multiple times. And so it's just a catastrophic situation. And, you know, if you say that the hospitals are like in the 70s, it means that they don't have, you know, 40, 50 years of modern technology available to them. And it's caused by politics and war. It doesn't have to be that way. When I go there, one of the things that is so painful is, you know, a hospital like Hadassah Hospital, it's not that far away. You know, right. People come from all over the world to get Israeli health care, and yet the Israelis are blind to what's happening right in their doorstep, and that they're responsible for. So it's a pretty outrageous situation and a medical emergency way beyond what the level of attention it's receiving in the press or, you know, it's just kind of stunning.
And some of the interviews that I've seen and read from doctors in Gaza, they're saying that they've never seen injuries quite like these before. They believe mm-hmm. that these bullets that are being used are a new technology.
Right. You know, there's a long history of the Israelis rolling out new technologies on Gazans. And in fact, there is an expression in the ammunition industry that things have been field tested. Mm-hmm. And often they've been field tested on Palestinians. So I've read reports that these bullets are somehow new and more horrific than other bullets. And also that there's some new kind of gas they're using because there's been a huge amount of tear gas, and we don't know what's in the tear gas, but there are all kinds of tear gas. And apparently some of the gas has caused convulsions and hallucinating and people screaming in pain. And it's just not your average tear gas. So who knows what kind of assault this has been, and the Israelis certainly don't share that information with the doctors who are trying to treat the patients. But the level of soft tissue and bone injury is very unusually high. And what's happening is that because they don't have the technical facilities to deal with this, they're tending to have to amputate. And so many, 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 many young people, since there are thousands of people that are injured, are now losing their limbs solely because of the kinds of bullets that were used and then the inability of the healthcare providers to respond to the need given the political situation.
I'm Esti Chandler. This is Middle East in Focus on KPFK. I'm discussing the emergency medical situation in Gaza with physician, author, and activist Dr. Alice Rothschild. Dr. Rothschild, 3 days after medic and nurse Razan Al-Najjar was shot and killed, her cousin, Ramzi, was also shot dead at a Great Return March demonstration. And unbelievably, this week, their baby cousin, born this month with respiratory distress, also died in Gaza. The baby's mother went into labor early and with medical supplies severely limited due to the Israeli enforced blockade that you were discussing, and civilians are now dying of ordinary treatable illnesses. Would you go so far as to say that lifting the siege of Gaza at this time is a medical emergency?
Sure. So first of all, I want us to just stop and think about the trauma to that family, which is beyond belief. It is pretty clear to me that lifting the siege is not only a medical emergency, but a water emergency, an electricity emergency. I mean, it's an emergency on so many levels that are related to humanitarian need. Gaza is an emergency, and the siege is sort of the source of this urgent disaster. So I think that people of conscience who can recognize that Palestinians are fellow human beings and they deserve the same things that we deserve can actually say enough. I keep finding people where every new outrage finally turns some more people to say enough. And I think we're clearly way beyond the level of enough. And I would definitely say this is a medical emergency. And as I said, a lot of other human rights, health care, public health kinds of emergencies. I mean, think of what's happened to the environment when you think about the level of toxic munitions that have rained down. I mean, this is a strip of land 6 miles by 26 miles in size. It's not a big place. It's a little piece of land that has, open sewage draining into the Mediterranean because they can't rebuild the treatment plants because they can't get things through the blockade. I mean,
right.
There's so many levels of emergency that are medical and public health. It's pretty stunning.
In our last few minutes, your most recent book, Condition Critical, Life and Death in Israel-Palestine, which was published last year and which I quoted from at the opening of the show, is comprised of a series of blogs written during your travels in Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. Pivoting to the subject of what people can do, in your epilogue, you write about the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. You write, quote, "As a Jewish person, I find this history shameful, immoral, and profoundly unrelated to what I learned as Jewish values and the legacy of Jews in a variety of progressive and intellectual movements. I suspect in the tradition stretching from the Quaker-led fight against slavery to the anti-apartheid struggles in South Africa, this nonviolent resistance movement may be the most promising and productive international effort to date." My question is, was coming to support the tactics of BDS to leverage people power against Israel's powerful military occupation a difficult condition for you to come by?
So I had a journey similar to many American Jews, where I started out in a very lovely Zionist family that loved Israel and couldn't imagine that Israel could do anything wrong. And so for me, the journey involved, becoming more active in the 60s and then really struggling with my adult politics and my childhood love of Israel. But once I started studying the history, listening to Palestinians, traveling to the region, meeting colleagues in Israel and the West Bank and Gaza, the issues became increasingly clear. And for me, when I finally became more acquainted with the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement, which involves a call to boycott, divest, and sanction Israel until Palestinians with Israeli citizenship are given the same rights as Jewish Israelis, and until the occupation ends, until there's a resolution of the refugee crisis. When this call came out, for me it was actually sort of a breath of fresh air, because what I saw was that there was a whole population that was oppressed, and when they responded violently, they were condemned. And so here was a nonviolent movement. In my book, the world should actually welcome that. And there's a long history of very principled BDS movements that have created political change. So the more I learned about it, the more it made sense. And the thing that was so disturbing for me is that the same people who condemned Palestinians for violent resistance also condemned them for nonviolent resistance. So you can't have it both ways. So I think that the BDS movement is actually a very powerful force. It is growing internationally. I think different populations and countries and governments are reassessing their position towards Israel. we have light years to go because, first of all, the U.S. is not doing that. But I do think it is one of the most promising strategies to confront the injustices that we see on a daily basis.
Thank you so much, Dr. Alice Rothschild, author of Condition Critical, Life and Death in Israel-Palestine, for your time and wisdom today. We appreciate it very, very much.
Well, thank you.
TED, Technology Entertainment Design, is a media organization that posts talks online for free distribution. Like their slogan, Ideas Worth Spreading, those talks often spread virally. TED was conceived in 1984 by architect and graphic designer Richard Saul Wurman, who observed a convergence of the fields of technology, entertainment, and design. For millions of people around the world, TED Talks have informed us about topics we never imagined being interested in. They've opened up our imaginations to dreaming about new places, realities, concepts, and ideas. And they've opened our hearts to people and situations we've had no experience with and no or little knowledge about. The TED Residency Program is an incubator for breakthrough ideas. It is free and open to all via competitive application. Those chosen as TED residents spend 14 weeks at TED headquarters in New York working on their ideas. Although some may produce a work of art, a manuscript, or an amazing theorem, each resident also develops a TED talk and delivers it on a TED stage. Our next guest, Dr. Maitha Alhassan, was a member of the spring 2017 class of TED residents. At the end of that program, she too had the opportunity to give a TED talk about her work and ideas. Dr. Alhassan gave what I believe is a groundbreaking TED talk, which offers an emotional portrayal of her ancestral homeland of Syria, beyond the reporting of geography and conflict and violence that, as she writes, artfully portrays the history of the land, its people, practices, beauty, and the legends it carries of rebel queens. Dr. Maitha Alhassan is a Syrian-American journalist, poet, and scholar. Her work bridges the worlds of social justice, academic research, media engagement, and artistic expression. In 2015, Dr. Alhassan established and designed the Social Justice Institute in collaboration with the Office of Student Affairs at Occidental College to train fellows in social justice praxis. She served as a 2014 core steering committee member of Muslim Anti-Racism Collaborative, working on their early digital organizing campaigns, addressing racism in the Muslim American community, and as a research associate. For the last 4 years, she's worked with refugee populations from Turkey to Greece as a journalist, translator, and healer. Last October, Dr. Alhassan piloted her Yoga to Displaced People program, a trauma-informed yoga intervention geared towards displaced and marginalized peoples. She's written for CNN, Boston Review, Huffington Post, and Counterpunch, among other publications, and is the editor of Demanding Dignity, Young Voices from the Front Lines of the Arab Revolutions, which was published in 2012. She has been featured on CNN, BET, Al Jazeera, and NPR, among other media outlets, and appears regularly as a guest co-host and digital producer on Al Jazeera English's current events program, The Stream. And thankfully, Dr. Alhassan also consults on the depiction of Arabs and Muslims for documentaries, feature films, and TV projects. It is my great pleasure to welcome Dr. Maitha Alhassan back to Middle East in Focus.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's been too long. Nagwa's not here with us today. It's just me. But, you know, thrilled to have you, and there's so many things you've been working on that I want to talk to you about, starting with the fact that you are a true Southern California hybrid, and I say that as a native SoCal girl myself. You seem to have your finger on the pulse of so many cutting-edge projects. You recently got your doctorate from USC, go Trojans. Your dissertation was in American Studies and Ethnicity. You received your bachelor degree in political science in Arabic and Islamic studies from UCLA, and your master's degree in anthropology from Columbia University in 2008. While you were at USC, you assisted in the launch of the Middle East Studies program, which is now a department. Can you talk about the importance of that department and how all these related disciplines have helped pave your path?
I do say I am somewhat of a Los Angeles stereotype, and I have blended the worlds that are here and my own cultural upbringing as well to try to navigate this world and beyond the U.S. And so when I entered USC in a PhD program that was incredibly interdisciplinary, it relied on other departments to help me do the training I needed for my project. But when I came in, the Middle East Studies program was 1 year in the making. So to get the listeners to understand what this means, a lot of universities in the U.S. have Middle East Studies programs, including UCLA, where I did the Arabic and Islamic Studies part of my degree. And then I went to Columbia, and it's been a department for decades. So I was a little confused by the fact that this university, which sees itself as top 25 in U.S. World and News Report institution, did not invest resources that were necessary to do this global thinking and to be engaged with the Middle East in this manner. And especially in a city like Los Angeles, where there's a massive, quote-unquote, Middle Eastern population, people from Iran, who some call themselves Persian, Turkish people from the other parts of the Middle East. And so I came on board with my faculty advisor, and we were a team of two people. And for people to understand the difference from a program and a department, a program is not that well funded, and students can get minors, but not necessarily majors in that field. So we knew we had to invest in the building of this to a point where it would become a department. So it was very do-it-yourself. I made the first logo for the department with Arabic calligraphy. Wow. We had a budget, I believe, of $10,000 for programming for the entire year. I think I was paid $4,000 for the year, and we were just a team of two. But we were able to recruit people who were incredibly talented in our field to the university through our programming. And now I'm happy to say it's a department, but I've always had a history of, if something is not available to me because of my organizing background, because of the way my father, who is an entrepreneur, raised me, I go in and I try to, I don't want to say fix things, but I try to take them to the level I know they're capable of being.
Well, just as a follow-up, now that it's a department, do you think that it might be in jeopardy by the confirmation of pro-Israel advocate Kenneth Marcus by the U.S. Senate on Thursday as the head of the Office of Civil Rights at the Department of Education under Betsy DeVos? Many rights groups on behalf of a wide range of affected student groups and communities say that they believe Kenneth Marcus will likely use his position to undermine the civil rights protections for students and further his career, which has been one of suppressing speech critical of Israel on college campuses and defunding Middle East studies programs.
Yeah, I want to say a couple things before I hit your question very directly. One is there's an incredible whiteness of being still in Middle East studies programs and departments that had to shift from an area studies model that saw the Middle East as part of this diplomatic projects as almost this soft power way of engaging with the Middle East. Let's get intel on it so that we can control it by virtue of quote-unquote diplomacy and diplomacy programs. But places like an American Studies program that sometimes have a much more radical politics can move from the area studies model and use decolonial critiques and approaches. So we have to think about the pluses and minuses within these fields, and the Middle East Studies programs and departments come from an area studies model, but they have shifted because of the people who've entered them. People like me, my generation of scholars, one generation back as well, have really shifted the politics of these departments. Now, with that said, there is a lot more work to do, but the threat of them being undermined also is very present. But I've said this on the Young Turks before. This administration is committed to dismantling federal programming. That's why you've seen people positioned like a DeVos in education, like a Carson in Department of Housing, like a you can think of any of the departments, and they were put to destroy those departments so that there would be a shifting investment from the state putting money and funding education, labor, housing, energy, relying on private sector. And the private sector, as we know it, has very self-serving interests, including the ways that they're invested in a security industry and a weapons industry that Israel is so strongly involved in. So there definitely is a very, as we know, the 45's administration is very strongly aligned with a Netanyahu government. So clearly they bend towards the will of that regime.
Right.
Unfortunately. And we have to be very well aware of what is happening so that we can create movements that go to the root of what their ideological war is tied to.
Exactly. Scott Pruitt at the Environmental Protection Agency comes
yes.
to mind. I'm Esty Chandler. This is Middle East in Focus on KPFK. I am speaking with Syrian-American journalist, poet, and scholar Dr. Maitha Alhassan about her work, which bridges the worlds of social justice, academic research, media engagement, and artistic expression. Dr. Alhassan, I'd love to know more about your Yoga to the Displaced People program that works and offers services like language classes and psychosocial support to refugee women and some of the communities you've been able to bring it to thus far.
Yeah, thank you for highlighting that. So I've been working in Greece for the last couple of years, but worked in different geographies with refugees. And before that, I worked with incarcerated youth. So I think about displacement a lot. And that's why I called it Yoga to the Displaced People, because the intention was to take a trauma-informed, healing-centered approach to the unique challenges that people who are uprooted and displaced are facing, that traditional methods of psychosocial support might not have within its language of healing. So I went to Greece last October for a month, and I worked with this women's center in this island called Chios, which is considered a hotspot, which means that people who are in transit coming from mostly Turkey and arriving by boat, we're supposed to stay there for maybe a couple days max and then try to continue their journey towards Northern Europe. But when the borders closed, that meant that everything was put on hold, and some people ended up staying for, at longest I heard, more than a year. So the conditions of the situation are really dire. Especially women and their needs are never prioritized. And that goes from showers that are co-ed, no privacy, no attention to women's pre- and postnatal health. So I worked with this women's center that offered language, psychosocial support. I translated psych appointments, which were incredibly devastating. Their stories still haunt me to this day. Translated medical appointments. My Arabic is not that strong to know the words in the medical field, but I had to rise to the occasion. So I did this yoga program, and even within a week's end, I saw a teenager who came consistently, and she breathed. She was breathing during Shavasana with a glow on her face. And I knew that this practice that intervened in a critical point in my life could have a strong impact on other folks' lives, and also just a practice that people can carry with them. They don't necessarily even need a mat. They just carry the asanas, carry the breath with them, and hopefully they can continue on in their journey with a moment of breathing. So that was my intention with it, and I piloted it, as I said, last October, and so I'm hoping to see what the next iteration is. I might be going back to Greece this summer and some other parts of Europe to connect with folks and offer this program.
This sounds fantastic. Thank you so much for doing this. As a professional communicator, you're well aware of that words have meaning, and that the words that we choose can affect change or sometimes actually support the status quo. So can you explain to us why our show should be called Northeast Africa or Marishk in Focus?
Yeah, thank you for that, and thank you for looking at what language I am offering. And the Middle East, like I was trying to hint towards, came from an area studies background that is rooted in a practice of Orientalism, which is a way that Europe looks at the quote-unquote Middle East as the Orient, as east of it. And so this language emerged from that. And what people who call themselves progressive and leftist and mostly from the academic space provided in resistance to this term was a term called Southwest Asia and North Africa, SWANA. I had a problem with this term, and I'll tell you why. One is that I started to do some investigating on what the East meant to this geography, and I realized that the East in Arabic, Sharq, and we call this region translated Middle East as Sharq al-Awsat, has two meanings. One is East and enlightenment coming from the idea that the sun rises from the East. And so when you have a term like Southwest Asia that completely erases the fundamental history of what the East meant to this region. Right. So I wanted to preserve that to some degree. And Mashrik is the term that means the East. So I flipped between that, but in order to two things, not erase non-Arabic speaking peoples, I wanted to think about something else in English, because Mashrik is an Arabic term. And also, after reading the work of people like John Henry Clark and Stokely Carmichael, who later called himself Kwame Ture, who are radical thinkers, historians, organizers, they offered Northeast Africa. And then recently, when I went to South Africa, and we're in discussion about the region and this term, and I presented this term that came out of a 1960s Black Power movement consciousness, I was met with resounding acceptance. And so I've been starting to really lean into Northeast Africa, because there is actually, it preserves the concept of the East, and there is, where's this division line between, right, you know, like, why is Egypt conceived of as part of the Middle East? Why doesn't it belong to Africa? And where's that imaginary border? And who imposed that imaginary border?
Right. And even in speaking about Israel, you see people saying it's on the Asian continent and other people saying it's on the African continent, and it's really unclear.
Yeah.
Well, this is fascinating and, you know, gives us all thought, you know, a lot to think about, you know, who names things and why and what they're erasing when they do so. This is Middle East in Focus on KPFK, and I am very happy to be speaking today with Dr. Maitha Alhassan, who is truly a Renaissance woman. We're going to soon talk about her TED Talk. She's a recent TED resident, and she works in so many fields in the arts, in media, in academia. Looking forward to also discussing her ancestral homeland of Syria. Before we get there, I wonder if as films like Peace, Propaganda, and the Promised Land, Valentino's Ghost, and the Occupation of the American Mind have documented, the portrayal of Arabs and Muslims in pop culture since the 70s has made America fertile ground for the kind of overt vilification of those communities that we've seen heat up since 9/11 and absolutely catch fire in the last few years. As a pop culture collaborative senior fellow and a consultant on feature films, TV projects, and documentaries, as I mentioned, what is your assessment of Hollywood and the entertainment industry as a whole in general's willingness to both deal with the role that they've played in the demonization of Arabs and Muslims and play a role in righting that wrong?
Yeah, my friend Rami, whose show got greenlit by Hulu, his series, I've been close to him throughout the whole process. He jokingly said after Trump was elected, yay, now we're going to get our project funded. And what he meant by that was that he hoped really dearly that people's eyes would be opened up in terms of the way that Hollywood was speaking for us in an imagined voice, imagined vision of us as solely a geography of violence. And he was right. After 11/9, I should say, the Hollywood industry, the machine, people who are showrunners, including Howard Gordon from 24 and Homeland.
What's the show so we can give it a plug?
Oh, his show is called Rami.
Oh, okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah. So people like Howard Gordon were asked point blank by the New York Times if he felt like his show contributed to the anti-Muslim sentiments in this country. And he was forced to confront the truth, and he said yes. And there were other folks who were showrunners and asked their networks if they could completely dead storylines about terrorism in shows about counterterrorism. So I think there was a general awakening, even though people like me and other folks in the Muslim and Arab community have been doing so much work, including the late Jack Shaheen, to try to transform this narrative that's existed almost 100 years, probably even longer. And so this report that I'm writing for Pop Culture Collaborative looks at the representation of Muslims on TV and film for the last 100 years, very much inspired by Jack Shaheen's book, Real Bad Arabs, R-E-E-L, and wanting to provide something for a larger community of people and cultures and traditions and ethnicities that were not included in the Arab version, right? So Black Muslims, South Asian Muslims, queer Muslims, women in a much more engaged fashion. So that's what I'm hoping to do with my report. And I would say that there's a plus and minus to where we are in this moment. One is that shows like The Brave, which rested, was a network show that was presented a couple months ago, that rested on the laurels of this good Muslim, bad Muslim paradigm, is canceled. So shows where an Arab character is a terrorist, or it plays a CIA agent who's going to be an informant in a terrorist cell, America doesn't have an appetite for that anymore, thankfully.
Right.
And we're starting to see more authentic narratives told by the very people that live them. And what we come to find is that, for the most part, one, this counterterrorism frame is only the frame we are living under because of the media's obsession with it. It's not something that we encounter every day in our lives, except for the fact when there are people in the Middle East who are the victims of these quote-unquote terrorist fundamentalist groups. And those are the real people who experience them. And it's not this imaginary boogeyman in the U.S. that folks are encountering on the daily, except on primetime news and in TV programming.
Right. I'm going to push this along because I want to leave time for your poem.
Oh, sure.
You recently completed your TED residency, and it culminated in a performance of a poem that you wrote for Syria, your ancestral homeland. It was a very unique departure from the standard TED Talk structure. Can you briefly tell us about coming to that decision, and then would you be so kind as to perform it for us?
Yes. Thank you so much for highlighting it. So a lot to think about. I was going to do a standard talk on breaking down and deconstructing our myths about immigration in the U.S., but it just felt stale. And during this period of time, the Trump administration had announced that it would launch airstrikes into Syria. And so people in my office were very curious as to my thoughts. And this was the first time that the Trump administration had announced it. As we know, that came to pass again a couple months ago. And I just felt like I was having the same conversations over and over again, even though it was only national security advisors and people with backgrounds in security, people with relationships to the military who were speaking on behalf of Syria on the news. So I just decided to intervene, as I said, with an emotional translation, hoping that people would see Syria beyond when there are reports of strikes, beyond when a toddler's body washes up on Turkish shores, beyond the first bombing and the last bombing.
So with our last minutes, would you please perform your poem for us?
Yes, thank you. I close my eyes and visualize every detail. The last time I saw you, it was 7 years ago today. We celebrated with family. Never appreciated you when I had you, summer romance shaded by jasmine shrubs. I plead with heaven and earth to reunite us so I can cleanse in your waters. Mediterranean blue brushed by eastern winds, I close my eyes to remember. You wore conquest and triumph on your face, lines 16,000 years deep, were robed in layers of empire, chest puffed in a warrior's armor. I knew you from stories, stories longer than a Bedouin's night. But then you stretch out your hand, offering me mint tea, cherries, and green pistachios from your garden. From Quiseda to Kebani, your poetry of the ancients charmed me. Makam Bayati emanating from oud strings, a sweetness as smooth as olive oil and as captive as honey. I close my eyes and watch you move from ruku to sujood to the rhythm of church bells. You practice every faith. You marveled at the devotion of each one, sealing Seder songs with surahs, bearing Christian saints in an artery wrapped around minarets. I close my eyes and I remember. Personality cult posters streaming down buildings, disfigured language, subversive jokes, rear-view mirror amulets. Remember that if it didn't please you, you silenced dissent, ignored and exacerbated debilitating poverty, a poverty so humiliating that many followed a death march towards impossible dignity. So crooked and meandering is the story of our love affair, I beg for a vision of the straight path. Sometimes I'm saddled with indignation. Why won't you let my heart break in peace to the dawn calm of silence? Offer me a morning without rubble, shelling, or torture, an afternoon free of hunger, homelessness, or longing. Save me an evening of suffocating uncertainty, chemical attacks, or propaganda. Some days I wake and I see your tears in my father's eyes, your hurt in the cold shoulder of my mother and her weighted heart. What part of my world I would give to see you again, but I am generations displaced, Arabic sterilized of its poetry, forever wandering for home, tormented incessantly as if inherited. Bandages expose flesh. You are a silent film rehearsed nightly on evening news. Little did they know your mother died a time too long ago. The scent of musk rose from a buried corpse under rubble. Rubble. Always rubble. Rubble. Stone, rubble, stone, My dear Syria, you are every filter I use to see the world. Temples, gardens, courtyards, biblical lands, in a prison state, you are more than a geography of violence. How I yearn for our people to have a voice loud and searing enough to quiet white noise that distorts stories, old and human. I stare at your face, a mirror. Though my father left in 1968, I too am a refugee camp, a carcass in an open graveyard, and a wish at the bottom of the sea. And then I close my eyes, beg your understanding, belonging to everywhere, neglected by everyone. She birthed myths, legend, midwife, pagan gods, Jewish prophets, Christian saints, Islamic knowledge, my grandparents. A time ago, perhaps too far for our collective memory, she buried the remains with dignity. Bruised, starved, kingdoms come down, rising from fatherland. Do we have a place in our hearts for the battered mother who reared prophets, carried temples on her spine, spread legs wide to labor fertile crescent? She who knocks down kings from the throne of the suns. With the dust of laurel leaves, she fingerprints their demise in cuneiform. Milked goats to feed a Rasul kin, placed a Baptist in Elizabeth's womb. She tosses back orange blossom water, soothing a belly inflamed by parasites of war. She rinses tongues in the Euphrates, cleansing the sins of our ancestors. Crooning freedom songs, she stomps on treaties and borders inked by madmen. She runs with hawks and wolves across a land between two rivers. Azaba, descendant of Cleopatra, queen of the desert, named Lover. She's been witnessed too many times to catastrophe before, so she knows another sky awaits.
That is just gorgeous. I cannot thank you enough, Dr. Maitha Alhassan, for taking the time to join us today and share with us about your work in the arts, media, academia. It spans so many different topics, and thank you very, very much. That is so moving.
It's an honor to be in conversation. Thank you, and thank you for programs like yours that give voice to all these different paths that I've lived within and through, and these voices that I've also carried with me, too. So thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Maitha Alhassan. I also want to thank our first guest, physician, author, and activist, Dr. Alice Rothschild. Her most recent book is Condition Critical, Life and Death in Israel-Palestine. You can find out more about her work at alicerothschild.com. And again, Syrian American journalist, poet, and scholar, Dr. Maitha Alhassan. You can learn more about her work and get a link to her beautiful TED Talk, Beyond a Geography of Violence, at her page, MaithaAlhassan.com. We have posted links to both of their websites at our Middle East in Focus Facebook page. I also want to thank our fantastic production help from Josh Shear. For KPFK Los Angeles, I am SD Chandler, thanking you for taking this hour to put the Middle East in focus.
This is Campbell Scott, and you're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, 93.7 FM in San Diego, and 99.5 FM in Ridgecrest and China Lake. Also streaming online at kpfk.org.
This is Sonia Barrett, host of The Expansion Zone, and KPFK would like to thank you for all of your contributions in this past fund drive.
It's because of your support that we're able to bring you the best in news, analysis, and conscious programming like Sonia Barrett. So on behalf of all of us at KPFK, thank you.
The second annual International Samba Congress will transport Los Angeles into Brazil from June 14th to the 17th at Downtown Dance and Movement. This four-day event is a gathering of over 30 experts of Brazilian dance, music, culture, and history, with classes, workshops, lectures, and performances. We will expand attendee knowledge, foster a deeper sense of connection of Brazilian culture, and share the healing power of samba. The event starts with the Grand Open Gala, Pioneer of Samba Night, which will honor the single legend, Dionne Warwick, for her work at Recicla Vidas, Recycle Lives, a charity in the favelas of Vidigal in Rio de Janeiro. Dion has supported different social projects in Brazil for decades. The second annual International Samba Congress, Thursday, June 14th to Sunday, June 17th, in Downtown Dancing Movement, located at 1144 South Hope Street, Los Angeles, California, 90015. For more information and tickets, go to internationalsambacongress.com or visit kpfk.org.